ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Tasmanian AFL fans celebrate the approval of Hobart's controversial new stadium. Also, yet another state Liberal leader out of a job, this time in South Australia. And the mythical Australian drop bear makes its horror movie debut.
That's what the bloody drop bear wants you to think.
I spent a long part of last year in Europe spreading the myth. It was not just a hobby, but I feel like a point of national pride.
In Tasmania, AFL fans are celebrating the state parliament's approval of a new Hobart stadium. Yesterday's late-night vote brings to an end years of debate about the project and means the dream of Tasmanian Aussie rules fans to have their own team in the national competition will soon be realised. Miwa Bloomer filed this report.
All right. Thanks everyone for coming along. So what we
After years of campaigning, those who've been working to establish an AFL team in Tasmania were on a high today.
Look, clearly it's an incredible result last night that was delivered through Parliament.
Brendan Gale is the Chief Executive Officer of the Tasmanian Devils, which is aiming to enter the AFL in 2028.
There has been uncertainty. We have kept our eye on the ball. We've focused on the present. We've controlled the controllables and got about building our club day by day. But this does remove a considerable amount of uncertainty. The stadium will be built. We will be playing in 2028. And so we look forward to getting on the business of building a football club, building our organisation, and most importantly, building our football teams.
Also with the Devils is Kath McCann. She's the club's social impact general manager and says there's still a long way to go before the club can put a team on the park. That includes entering initial men's and women's teams into the second tier of the Victorian League.
But in some respects, the game's just about to begin. We've got a lot of work to do, and we're really looking forward to not just taking the field in 28 with our men and women, but ultimately kicking off in VFL and VFLW early next year.
Building the new stadium was a requirement laid out by the AFL when it granted Tasmania a licence to start a new club. And some fear that licence would be cancelled if Parliament didn't get on board. There's been fierce opposition to the stadium, especially from some independent MPs, mainly because of its cost of $1.1 billion, and fears that cost could blow out further. After 2 days of tense debate in the state's upper house, the final vote was 9-5 in favour of proceeding with the stadium. And this morning, the Premier was savouring victory.
All right, let's go right in front of the camera.
Get one of your team to, I want to open the camera.
Jeremy Rockliffe has staked huge political capital in making this happen.
The democratic process has taken its place. I said that the order would be approved, the stadium would be approved by both houses of Parliament, and it has. Today we can move forward with this project. We can move forward. And unifying Tasmania.
Master Builders Tasmania CEO Jenna Kearney says there's a complicated process ahead to get the stadium built.
Tomorrow on Saturday we'll be releasing two requests for tenders. They'll be to commence the bulk excavation, so to clear the way for the stadium on this site, and also to start the process of packing down the good shed, which will be relocated to the north of the site. We'll then in January be starting the process to appoint our major contractor, who will have the exciting job of bringing this dream to a reality. In the coming months after that, we'll be announcing some of those appointments, and we're really excited to get started. The order that passed through the Parliament last night has a number of conditions, and we'll also be working on those. One of the first key things we'll be doing is a staging plan. That's set out in the order at B2. And it requires us to set out across the project what are the key stages and what are the works that will happen in those. So I think that will be a really interesting document, not only just to help us get moving, but for people to see what will be happening in each stage as we go through that delivery phase. But we're just really excited to be able to start the process and to finally bring this dream to reality.
AFL Chief Executive Andrew Dillon says he's looking forward to the next steps.
I've always been really confident that we get to the result where we are today, and there's still a lot of hard work to do before the Devils start in the AFL competition in 2028 and the AFLW later that year, but also starting VFLW and VFL next year.
The stadium is scheduled to be completed in time for the 2029 men's AFL season, while the Tasmania Devils will enter the AFL in 2028 and play at least its first season at Belrive Oval and York Park.
Miwa Bloomer with that report. Well, yet another state Liberal leader is out of a job. South Australia's Vincent Tarsia has stepped down today, just 3 months before the next state election. It's the fourth Liberal leadership change in the states and territories in the last month, after resignations in New South Wales and the ACT and a leadership spill in Victoria. And pundits are tipping the South Australian Libs will follow the lead of their New South Wales and Victorian colleagues and install a first-term female MP in the top job. Luke Radford has more.
For months, the South Australian Liberal opposition has been under siege. With less than 100 days till the next state election, polling had them on track for an electoral wipeout. But even last week, party leader Vincent Tarsia was holding firm.
I'm not resigning. I'm here to fight for my community and this state and this party, and I'll be the leader for the election in March next year. It's as simple as that.
Today, that suddenly changed.
Politics is one of these games where you either come back with your shield or on it. And today I've made the decision to step down as leader of the Liberal Party. This is obviously a decision that hasn't come about lightly, but upon reflecting the various needs of my own family, I've got a four-year-old and a five-month-old at home, amongst quite a demanding role as leader of the opposition and also wanting to serve my electorate to the best of my ability.
Vincent Tarsia has only been South Australia's Liberal leader since August of last year. He's the third person to have the job since the last state election in 2022. However, when asked if he was pushed out of the role, Vincent Tarsia refused to bite.
I'm not going to stand here and say that any one of my colleagues has undermined me. I will do everything possible to support the next leader and make sure that they are as successful as possible for the next state election. I don't leave with any bitterness whatsoever.
With just 15 weeks till the next state election, the Liberal Party will need to pick a new leader quickly. Emeritus Professor of Politics at Adelaide University, Clement McIntyre, says whoever is chosen will face a significant challenge.
South Australian Liberal Party clearly is in trouble. Polling suggests it's going to lose seats the next election, not win them back. And some of the polling suggests dire outcomes with the party reduced to a handful of seats, if that. And it's not clear who is able to lead them out of that trouble.
One name has emerged as the clear frontrunner. Shadow Health spokesperson Ashton Hearn, a first-term MP, has been touted within the party as the most likely replacement for Mr. Tarsia. Professor McIntyre again.
She recently said she wasn't ambitious and wanted to take on that role. I think she is the most impressive of the shadow ministers in the Liberal Party at the moment, and she may well be able to re-galvanise the party a bit and give it a lift in its spirits, but whether that carries through to making a significant difference to the voters in March next year remains to be seen.
In a statement, Ms. Hearn thanked Vincent Tarsia for his service and says she'll spend the coming days speaking with colleagues ahead of the party room meeting. If chosen as leader, Ashton Hearn would become the third woman elected to lead a state Liberal Party in the past month, after the Libs in Victoria and New South Wales chose female leaders. Former Liberal strategist and Redbridge Group director Tony Barry says it's part of a larger change happening to the Liberal Party across Australia.
The imminent elevation of Ashton Hearn to the South Australian Liberal leadership and the recent elevation of Jess Wilson and Kelly Sloan as Liberal leaders in Victoria and New South Wales, it's beginning to look like the start of a reform project for the Liberal Party of Australia. Each are young professional women who are overachievers, but also I think they have a capacity through communication to connect with constituencies where the Liberal Party has been underperforming in recent times.
And Tony Barry says if they can't reconnect with those voters, they'll be stuck in the political wilderness.
Where the Liberal Party has been underperforming in all our research and polling has been in the Gen Z and millennial cohorts in particular, where at a federal and most state levels, they're polling in the high teens, mid-20s, and they simply can't be competitive as a political force unless they're performing better or more contestable positions than they currently are.
The South Australian Liberal Party will meet to elect its new leader on Monday.
Luke Radford reporting from Adelaide. In a first for Australia, skydiving instructors in three states are on strike. The industrial action follows a pay dispute with the industry's biggest employer, Experience Co's Skydive Australia. The Australian Workers Union says the current pay offer actually amounts to a drop in wages. Julia Bergen reports.
in three states, almost 60 skydiving instructors walked off the job today. They're taking action, angry over stalled pay negotiations with Skydive Australia.
It might sound surprising, but these workers started organising themselves and they came and found the Australian Workers Union to help them in their fight. And today is the first ever strike in this industry as we try to negotiate the first ever enterprise agreement for skydive instructors.
That's Jonathan Cook from the Australian Workers Union. The union is representing skydive instructors across eight sites in Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria.
Right now, their base rate is $57,000 a year, but they have access to a bonus, a productivity bonus. So the more they jump, the more productivity they give for the company, the more they earn. And then this fight really started when the company tried to claw that back.
For 10 months, the union has been in discussions with Skydive Australia. They want to boost that base rate to $65,000 a year. Skydive Australia wants to wind it back to $49,000. John O'Sullivan is in charge of Experience Co, the parent company of Skydive Australia. He's not happy about the strikes.
We're really disappointed with the actions of the AWU. We have been negotiating in good faith now for the last 10 months. We've made a number of proposals to the union and their delegates, and our latest proposal, which would see on average our full-time tandem skydivers earning just over $100,000 a year, to have this manifestly rejected and then, you know, this action implemented has been really disappointing, because we'd been given assurances during the negotiations and also privately from the AWU that this wouldn't be the case.
The Australian Workers Union says cuts to an instructor's income will be between $20,000 and $100,000 per year. They also claim Skydive Australia plans to scrap bonuses, something John O'Sullivan denies. He says instructors were never paid bonuses to start with.
They used to be contractors, and in response to COVID, because many of them felt that they wouldn't be able to get the number of jumps to support their livelihoods, we made the decision to make them employees, provide them with a minimum wage, superannuation, annual leave, workers' compensation. We never paid them bonuses. We paid them piece rates during the course of their work. The more they jump, the more they get paid. And that's exactly the model that we've put forward again.
David McAvoy is not involved in the strikes, but his Queensland company Skydive Ramblers trains instructors, including many that wind up working at Skydive Australia. He says becoming a qualified instructor is a long, expensive process.
It is fairly intense, since basically it's just related to the risk factor, you know, skydiving. So it's very thorough in the emergency procedures department and, you know, the situations that relating to safety.
There's also a string of licences required, A licence, B licence, C licence, D licence, and each one comes with more jumps and more advanced techniques. David McAvoy says while some people put that training towards competitions, others want to be instructors, and that deserves good pay.
To be a tandem master, you've got to do 1,000 jumps, and they're going to cost you $50 each at least, plus a lot more for the other bits and pieces. So you're looking at $50,000 to get there before you become a tandem master. That's your investment. And even more than that, really, but because, you know, you've got to buy equipment, and that's expensive just for starters. You know, then you've got all these courses, and they're not cheap. And then you've got to get your jump numbers up. It goes on and on. But once you become a tandem master, you're very specialised.
Skydiving instructor David McAvoy. That report from Julia Bergen. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a new Australian horror film starring the mythical Drop Bear set to scare the world.
And this movie is very proudly bad. It is bad on purpose. It is funny because it is bad, because we knew that going in. It's got so much heart, and you can see that on the screen. You can see the fun.
The prospect of a US brokered peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is again looking unlikely after the Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed his nation will seize more Ukrainian territory by force or other means unless Ukraine's troops withdraw from those areas and accept his demands to end the fighting. But Ukraine is refusing to concede any further territory to Russia. Mr. Putin's threats came as he started a visit to India for meetings with the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Nick Grimm filed this report.
It was pitched as the interview you've been waiting for, a world exclusive creating waves globally.
Dear viewers, hello and a very warm welcome.
And in his interview with media outlet India Today, Vladimir Putin vowed he's ready to continue his war in Ukraine unless his ceasefire demands are met in full.
Now they have pretty much fought themselves into a corner. All this boils down to one thing. Either we take back these territories by force, or eventually Ukrainian troops withdraw and stop killing people there.
After years fighting to hold its territory, Ukraine is also in no mood to surrender more land to Russia, despite that being one of the key elements of a peace deal being brokered by the US Trump administration. The 23-year-old commander of a Ukrainian artillery unit says hopes for peace are slender at best. He says, we don't feel any changes. We don't know what's going on there in terms of negotiations. But here in our defence area, the situation is the same as it was before. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Ukraine, Matthias Schmal, also reporting little sign on the ground that a negotiated breakthrough is close.
On the ground in Ukraine, and I travel around a lot, including to the eastern regions, it doesn't feel like we're anywhere close to a ceasefire. The war continues unabated, and there is really significant destruction going on the one hand of infrastructure in the energy side, which I'll come back to you in a minute, but also people's lives are being damaged, people are being killed and injured. So it's relentless in those terms. And there have been moments of cautious optimism. At the moment, I don't sense any optimism that we're getting closer to ending this terrible tragedy.
A tragedy that's set to become more difficult and costlier as the European winter sets in. Carl Bildt is a former Prime Minister of Sweden and co-chair of the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's told CNN Vladimir Putin has unrealistic expectations if he believes he can easily prevail on the battlefield.
You could say that Putin has, he probably still believes that he can militarily be successful. I don't think even his army believes that any longer, to be quite frank. He still believes that he can get Trump along in pressuring Ukraine into sort of caving in to him. I don't think that will work. He probably still believes that he can get the Europeans derailed from supporting Ukraine. I think that's going to fail as well.
Indian dancers greeting the Russian president as he touched down in New Delhi. With expanded economic ties on the agenda for his two-day visit to India, Vladimir Putin is keen to further boost sales of Russian oil to its long-time trading ally and enhance his credentials as an international statesman. Jennifer Parker is with the National Security College at the Australian National University.
Russia's position on Ukraine has not changed in the nearly 4 years since they invaded Ukraine. I think he's feeling emboldened by the fact that the leaking of the 28-point plan showed the US is leaning towards Russia's position in these negotiations. They have had some success inching towards the west on the battlefield in the Donbass, and this week they claimed to have seized the city of Provozhsk. Now, that's not necessarily clear that they have, but he's claiming this success. Of course, he's got a warm welcome as well from Narendra Modi in India, so he's feeling very confident about his position. On the other hand, Ukraine, who have been valiantly pushing back, are going into another difficult winter now where Russia has been actively targeting their energy infrastructure. So he's feeling confident, and you're seeing that in not only his comments of saying that he will either take the Donbass by force or by negotiations, but even his comments earlier in the week where he said in Moscow to a forum that he was ready for war with Europe if necessary.
Yeah, but winter is a double-edged sword as well. It's going to be difficult and slow to wage a war there in the months ahead, even for the Russians.
So it is going to be difficult. And actually, when you look at Russia's progress on the battlefield this year, yes, they have inched it a little bit further towards the west, but it hasn't been significant progress. And you've got to think, you know, a country with the size of the army of Russia, actually, they've been pretty ineffective in the last 4 years. Now, that does come on top of Russia having significant economic pressure being placed on them. And we saw that with, in fact, the US's recent pressure on India about importing Russian oil. So it isn't going all successfully for Russia in any way, shape or form. But you can tell in Putin's comments that he is still feeling confident. And a lot of that is because he's received a significant amount of support during this conflict from China and North Korea, which have allowed him to continue to prosecute this conflict.
Nick Grimm reporting. Well, it's not clear where the hoax of the Australian drop bear originated, but countless visitors to this country have been scared by warnings of koala-like creatures dropping from trees and attacking. Now a new low-budget horror film about the mythical drop bear has been made, and while the special effects may not rival those in Hollywood blockbusters, the film's cast and crew say projects like this are vital for the local film industry. Angus Randall prepared this report.
I had a mate once. He claimed that he wrestled a drop bear with his bare hands.
We've all been guilty of it at some point, warning tourists of the dangerous drop bear, which hunts by leaping from the trees onto its unsuspecting prey. Its origins are unclear, and depending on the storyteller, you can prevent drop bear attacks with a cork hat or some Vegemite behind the ears.
My God, no one thinks this is real.
That's what the bloody drop bear wants you to think.
A new low-budget comedy horror film is taking the drop bear myth to the big screen.
I spent a long part of last year in Europe spreading the myth. It was not just a hobby, but I feel like a point of national pride.
Actor and puppeteer Jos Mensch portrays the leader of the drop bears.
A great time trying to find the character of a giant mutated koala. Sort of was inspired by those horrible guttural growls that koalas make in the middle of the night.
Drop Bear was completed in just 4 months. This quick turnaround is the core business model of the independent American studio ITN Distribution. It releases dozens of films every year, with attention-grabbing titles like Bambi the Reckoning, Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey, and Dinosaur Hotel.
I'm a big believer that to have good movies, there must also be bad movies. And this movie is very proudly bad. It is bad on purpose. It is funny because it is bad. Because we knew that going in, it's got so much heart. And you can see that on the screen. You can see the fun.
It's the first Australian film funded by ITN. John Decoe is the director, writer and producer of Drop Bear.
A lot of people have attempted to make Drop Bear films over the years, and a few have got over the line, but a lot of them went for straight horror. If you're going to do a Drop Bear movie, it has to be that comedy horror. It's based on a joke. It's a joke that we play on tourists, a Descent of the Pitch document, and he was like, well, killer koalas, sounds fun. All right, we'll give it a crack.
He admits his movie may not be for everyone, but it's a callback to Australia's history of scrappy filmmaking.
We've kind of gone through this real period over the last 20 years of we were always going to have smaller budgets, but we're trying to emulate that $100 million budget on a $2 million budget. And I'm just like, well, let's have fun with it. Let's do what George Miller did with Mad Max. And like even The Castle is a perfect example. Is lean into what our strengths are.
With a budget of less than $100,000, this means the lead drop bear is clearly a man in a fluffy suit, and it's best not to look too closely at the horde of computer-animated koalas.
Let's try and make something that's fun. And every time we were going through the process, it was like, if we got a little bit janky, it was like, lean into it. Let's make this funny. Let's make this part of the charm of it all. And that's where I really set out to make a love letter to B-movies, but also take the piss out of B-movies.
Drop Bear was filmed in and around Adelaide. It's important to director John Decoe he could keep production close to home.
I want to stay here. As a filmmaker, as a director and the producer of these things, I'm the one that brings everybody in on these projects. And so I really want to keep people here because most of the time the work's over in the eastern states, if not overseas. And so that desire to leave for grass is greener on the other side.
It's a familiar story to those in the smaller states. Associate producer Jackson Johns is a recent uni graduate. Drop Bear is his first credit.
And I even had lecturers tell me, look, you know, you can study here, but you probably won't work here. And I'm a bit stubborn, so I didn't really like that. And I was very keen to see local productions start and see the amount of jobs open from just this one film. It was exciting. It was great. When that sort of stigma comes up that you won't find any work and South Australian work isn't good, I think that's just completely wrong.
Actor Jos Mensch says those who do stay are passionate about making the local scene thrive.
Yeah, a lot of people do leave for work. A lot of people also leave to get more experience and come back and share that experience. And that's sort of the path that I've chosen, is leaving for portions of time, getting more skills, getting more networks, and coming back and sharing that with the rest of us that are still here. We're still here. We're still making stuff.
There's already a Drop Bear sequel on the way. Filming is due to start next year.
Angus Randall with that report. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. PM will be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. The US has been building up its military forces in the Caribbean after months of deadly strikes on boats from Venezuela, it says, are smuggling drugs. Today, Latin America expert Orlando Perez on why Donald Trump is turning up the pressure on Venezuela's president and if it could edge the region towards conflict. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.